Hello and welcome to Pete's Percussion Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Zambito, here with episode 104 and the return of episode 2 and episode 32 guest and Pete's fellow Wake Forest alum, David Grubb. This past Saturday was the opening of Mizzou's 2018 football season, and it went as planned, at least football-wise. Mizzou soundly defeated Tennessee Martin 51-14. So there's that. And the band did well, considering it was 92 degrees at game time with a heat index right around 100 degrees. Myself and the marching Mizzou director, Dr. Amy Knops, made a decision a couple days before to forego the full dress wool uniform in favor of our new black polos and khaki shorts. It was the right move. We still had a few students, along with lots of attending fans, who would need some first aid. Or just some relief from the shade. But overall, we managed fairly well in the heat and direct sunlight. We got some support for us being in polos from an unlikely source, the SEC Network announcers. Sounds like we got it right. Looking forward to a great season ahead. All right, let's get to this week's guest. If you haven't gotten a chance, I strongly recommend checking out David's previous two appearances on the show. Links appearing in the show notes. As has been the case on various occasions for Pete's Percussion Podcast, I'll have guests from outside the world of percussion for various reasons. Sometimes it's because they're a good friend with a good story. Sometimes it's because of an unusual coming together of forces. Sometimes it's because my own career has put me in connection with folks outside of the percussion realm. Having David Grubb on, again, checks a number of those boxes. It was time to check in with David again because his career had taken a turn since the last time we checked. He's returned to his roots and gotten into sports journalism full-time and is an up-and-coming writer, reporter, and podcaster, as well as a radio and TV personality. He's been affiliated with Crescent City Sports since its inception last year and is beat reporter for the New Orleans Pelicans and LSU Tigers football team for this local online journal. I can't wait to see where it goes from here because I only see it going up and getting better for him. We recorded this interview over Skype on July 24th, 2018, and it begins right now. So David, I want to say, first off, I'm really proud of you, because of what's kind of gone on this year, is like all the things that you've been wanting to do, it, particularly in this last year, has really started to blossom. So I just want to say, I'm happy for you and proud of you.
Thank you. That really means something for. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. Because the last time we talked. I think the Crescent City Sports, who you're writing for, I don't know if it had gone live yet. It was like right around the time.
We were just getting ready to go online.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about the site and your role with it.
I'm listed as a contributing writer. And I am credentialed for both LSU football and the New Orleans Pelicans. And then I also cover high school football and some LSU baseball. But primarily the Pelicans and LSU football are my two beats. I also get to do some commentary on occasion, but they're, you know, mostly Louisiana-specific issues. We try to stay local, be the leader in local sports. Whereas with Sports and Olaw, I used to write a little bit more on the national issues confronting sports on occasion. But it's also given me opportunities. I do regular appearances on our sister radio station, WGSO, and do mostly basketball there. And I've been also working with KYOK in Houston, Texas, and I do a weekly check-in with them on Thursdays from 12:20 to 1 o'clock. So a lot of opportunities have been coming up and been doing podcasting with the Bird Rights They go through SB Nation, and they cover the Pelicans, of course, and but they also do some with Off the Glass Network, which covers basketball and all its incarnations. So yeah, it's been really, really a good year as far as getting my name out, expanding my base, more readers, more social media followers. And for me, you know, my mission has always been just to be somebody that brings more than just box score references and obvious interpretations of what's happening in sport. Like, I want you to feel like you were at the game. And if you weren't at the game, what was important about the game? You know, I don't like cookie cutter quotes, so I don't ask cookie cutter questions, you know. So I really enjoy what I do. You know, hopefully you try to make more money, and because this is a hard, we know journalism is just a hard field right now, make a lot of money. So you have to do a lot of things. And so I'm continuing to work on that. I've had some offers to do some TV, and also just to work on developing a podcasting network. So I'm, you know, weighing those things and trying to figure out what's going to be the next step. But, you know, the goal now is to continue to write good content, continue to put my name out there, and then hopefully assemble a team of writers and media personalities, people who want to expand even more and get more diverse voices into the field, because it's still just an overwhelming, especially sports talk. We know that it's just an overwhelmingly dominated by white males, and there's nothing wrong with white guys, you know, but it's just, there are a lot of different perspectives out there, and there's so many cities that have huge, you know, compositions of people of color who love their teams just as much and would like to hear somebody talk to them that looks like them. And you know, women, people of color, whatever, we need more participation, because I think sports is a great thing, and the more people who are talking about it and involved in it, the better for me.
Yeah. What's it been like to be to cover a beat for particularly the Pelicans, like to be that engrossed with one specific team for an entire year?
It's a grind, because you're doing two things. You're trying to build relationships with the team itself, because you want people to be able to talk to you. You want people to give you information that they may not give without you asking it. You know, it just doesn't come out in the course of conversation. And you also want to be fair, but I'm not a fan. That's not my job.
Right.
My job is to be a journalist. And there are a lot of people who will get upset and say, you know, why don't you write more positive things? I'm like, well, they just lost by 20 points at home to Sacramento. I can't really be that positive.
Yeah.
So it is a grind, because emotionally people, you know, expect certain things of you as a writer. The players expect certain perspectives. They don't want to be diminished. They don't want to feel like they've been misquoted. They don't want to feel like they're saying anything that they don't mean. So sometimes you have to do favors by them and reinterpret for them what they're saying. You understand what they meant. They may have not just said it the right way, and you know, you clean it up for them. And also just the part where there are parts of the season where you feel like you've done every storyline. Like, what am I writing about now? What questions am I going to ask? When they're in a 5-game losing streak, you know, hey, by game 4, you've run out of ways to say, what are you going to adjust to, coach?
Yeah.
You know, who needs to step up? Because the problem's there. You know what it is. You've watched it for 4 straight games now. So, you know, those can be hard. And on nights when guys are prickly if they played a bad game or lost a game that they thought that they were supposed to win, you know, yeah, I've been cursed out in the locker room before, and I've been yelled at, you know. Last year, only once. Rajon Rondo was the only person yelling at me last year, so that was, you know, all right. But, I mean, when you've been yelled at by Alexia Jensa, who didn't play a game last season, you know, you kind of start to get over yourself, you know, so.
You're like, I got yelled at by an NBA champion. That was, it's like, I'm making my way in the world.
Right, you know, so those are interesting. And then, of course, you know, there are things that bring you simple pleasures. I've gotten to run into Wake Forest alums. You know, Chris Paul, of course, when he comes to town, he recognizes me now. And be like, hey, Wake Forest, yeah, what's up? You know, you see Jeff Teague. And I was the one who told Jeff Teague that Wake Forest didn't get a recruit that ended up going to Duke. And it was right before a game. He's like, man, you know, just that Wake Forest bond is still there, and these guys are NBA players now. And, you know, you're talking to guys. I can talk to guys who played with Tim Duncan, and they have stories, and I have a couple, you know, a couple. But it's just interesting because they're like, oh, you knew Tim back then? What was he? Yeah, same guy. Yeah. It's no different. But, you know, those are the things you really enjoy. Plus, I just love basketball. So on a night-to-night basis, people are paying me and feeding me and letting me watch basketball, you know, for 41 nights a year. That's the dream for me, man. It's just, you know, just give me more money. But
right.
To get paid to do that, that's all I ever wanted.
In what ways has being around the game that much in that small window of time kind of improved your enjoyment? What kinds of things are you seeing now that you, even before that point, you hadn't necessarily been noticing?
You know, I think it's like a version of what people talk about when you watch football. You know, people, it's easy to watch the edges where the wide receivers are and the running backs, but nobody watches the offensive line. And so much of the play is happening at the line.
Right.
And I've kind of become more of that way with the way I watch basketball now, is that I'm not watching the ball. I'm watching what's going on away from the ball a lot more. And I mean, you know, you and I both have been around the game so much, and, you know, I've coached kids, I've coached high schoolers, stuff like that. And you always watch the game from a distance, but it's easy when you get caught up in the NBA because there are stars in front of you and you're looking to see plays.
Right.
As a fan of the game, to miss the nuance. And because I have to write about that, and because I have to, that obligation I have to the reader to let them see turning points and what they can't see or what they have not learned to see, then I really have to pay attention. I have to see when a guy misses a cut. I have to see when somebody leaves too early on their screen. You know, those are the things that I'm paying attention to a lot more, because – you know, where people are talking about those last shots are the most important part of the game. No, it can be, you know, a missed opportunity in the middle of the third quarter that turns the game. Yeah. And you have to pay attention for those. And so, yeah, that's how I watch it more now.
Yeah. Are you picking up pointers for your own pickup hoops game, too, while you're at it?
Man, at this stage, at, you know, 43 creeping up.
Yeah.
I'm just hoping, as long as I get up and down.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like there are no real moves anymore. It's turned into the Charles Barkley at the end of his career. Just put my butt on him, back him down, and see what I got.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have any moves anymore. I'm getting a little bit quicker. You know, I lost a little bit of weight.
Yeah.
Getting good. Quicker.
Yeah.
But got more to do before I can start trying things.
Yeah. I didn't know if you had how good your across the paint cross screening was going, or if you were if your boxing out is even better than it was. You know,
the boxing out has stayed solid. The
okay,
base
good.
Is still strong.
Good.
Okay.
Good.
The base is still strong. The problem is that you'll call a screen for people, and a lot of times in pickup, they don't know what to do.
Right.
Because they never run off a screen and roll.
Yeah.
And they're sitting there setting up the guy forever. You're like, I can't hold the screen for right. 6 seconds. Just go one way or the other.
Yeah.
Make your move.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just something. Yeah, pick and roll with people you don't know very well is painful.
Yeah.
You know?
What was it like the first time in a press conference when you actually got called on? Were you like... were you like doing...
In my life?
Were you like...
Like going... Oh, my gosh. Okay, going back, the first time I get was when I was at Wake Forest.
Yeah.
And doing Wake Forest TV, and it was a Duke game.
Uh-huh.
And Wake Forest had beaten Duke. And so you go to do the Duke press conference.
Mm-hmm.
And first, it was the first part of it was basically 10 minutes of Mike Krzyzewski cursing.
Yeah, of course.
Like, right. And people who don't know Mike Krzyzewski think that he's this kind teacher of the game.
He's a potty mouth.
He's the most profane.
Yes.
Him and Gary Williams could have gone blow for blow and curse for curse.
Yeah.
And just for hours on end.
I know.
Like, Gary Williams might be the only person that could give Mike Krzyzewski a beatdown in just total use of profanity in a 2 hour span.
Right, yeah.
But, you know, so I asked a question that he didn't like. And I don't even remember the question. I just know he didn't like it. Mm-hmm. So he basically cursed me out for 2 minutes. That was my first press conference. And then I've also had guys like Greg Lloyd stared at me for a good 2 minutes in the Panthers locker room once when I asked a question. Like, he didn't know who I was. He had never seen me before.
Yeah.
So he let me know, don't ask any more questions just by staring at me. So I got that message. But my biggest blunder in a press conference was during media day for the Pelicans 2 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And Anthony Davis was on the dais, and I said something about him not making the All-Star game, but what I meant was not making All-NBA. And he looked at me, he's like, All-Star? You sure you watched the game? You just started, did you see? It was too late.
Yeah.
He was just, I was done. But yeah, I mean, it's cool when you get home and you see the question you asked to Alvin Gentry, on SportsCenter that night or something. Yeah, that's always good. Like, I knew I asked a good one.
Yeah.
I got that one in, and you see it in the post-game cut on the local sports station. You're like, see? Yeah, there I am. All right. I'm the smart guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, it's competitive, too. I mean, guys, there are people I'm competitive with in a positive way,
mm-hmm.
who are other journalists in the area and writers and bloggers and who I like competing with. Mm-hmm. And then there are other ones who are, not so much. Guys who I don't understand why they do sports.
Mm.
Because they don't understand the game.
Yeah.
They're asking rudimentary questions of NBA players. And players, will let them know that they don't like those kinds of questions. And,
right.
Or they're just not joyful about it. It's like, losses aren't fun.
Right.
But at the end of the day, we're writing about entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
It can only be but so serious. And while I'm there watching a game, I've watched many bad basketball games in that building.
Yeah.
But while I'm there, again, it's like pizza, right?
Yeah.
It's still pizza.
Yeah.
You're still eating pizza. It could be worse. Uh-huh. I'm in an NBA arena right now watching basketball. And, what else would I be doing right now?
Yeah.
What else would I be doing? I'd be watching basketball in my house.
Yeah. So, eating pizza.
Yeah, so here I got salad and jambalaya tonight, that made me good.
Yeah.
So it's a dessert tray.
Yeah.
All the drinks I can hit muster. And then we get halftime, we get cookies and nachos. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing. And post-game, they serve you beer. I don't drink it because I got to drive home. But
right.
There's a big cooler beer for all the riders after the game. So I'm like, yeah. What's better than that? That's the life, dude.
That is awesome. How's it been building sources for your writing? What's that process been like?
It's really difficult. I've been fortunate that I've been able to use some ends, use a lot of third parties to get that first conversation with somebody you need to talk to. So when I was with LSU, DJ Chark was the leading receiver for the team last year. I knew his sister, so she introduced us, and I knew that post-game I could get good quotes from him, that he would always be there and available for me if I couldn't get anybody else. With the Pelicans, you start making friends. The people to make friends with are agents, wives,
mm-hmm.
and beat reporters from other towns. Those are the first people you get to know really well, because they will tell you who you need to talk to. With Anthony Davis, that's the guy that I have a closest connection to, as far as having information to be accessible to him.
Mm-hmm.
I can go get to him if I need to. It's rarely a face-to-face thing because he just doesn't handle his business that way. Mm-hmm. But if there are questions that I can ask. And, of course, there are agreements that get made, too. There are a number of times where I've pulled Alvin Gentry to the side after we've had our press conference and asked him a couple of questions for my own personal confirmation, so when I go back to write my story, I know I'm not going in a wrong direction.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to use what he tells me, in the story, because I'm trying to maintain our relationship for the point that when I really need something important, he feels comfortable in letting me know. rather than keeping me on the outside.
Wait, do you mean that you won't you'll say something but won't attribute it to him?
Right. Okay. Right. So like if I saw something in the game strategically, I'll ask him about a decision after the game. I'll say, Coach, it looked like you did this because of this. Mm-hmm. And he'll say, yeah, it was an adjustment to such and such. You know, we really didn't want to do the – I'm not going to use all of that.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because some of that is – it's you never want it to seem like the coach is trying to implicate. And it's very easy to do that when something breaks down at the end of a game at a loss. And to say, well, you know, maybe we didn't want this guy to get it. And the coach is not going to say that during the major press conference. You know, he's not going to say that wasn't the way to play. We know a lot of times, unless the coach is specifically calling a guy out, he's not going to say, no, it didn't go to the right guy.
Right.
But there are times after the game where you do find out that the play didn't go as scripted, or that the wrong person threw it in. And what you want to – then it becomes, in reporter jargon, it'll be things, you know, like, it turns into miscommunication. There was a miscommunication on the play.
Right.
Not this guy wasn't supposed to be on the floor.
Yeah.
You know. So you end up figuring out, okay, how am I going to word this to protect everybody involved but still tell the truth? I'm not going to lie for anybody. You know, that's never been my way. I do not do that. I don't cover things up. If I have information that I feel like I want to go with, we have a good relationship with the Pelicans media people. And there are times that, you know, you just go straight to them. Like, I heard this, 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 and this. Tell me what's the truth. And, you know, if they deny it, then, you know, you have that on the record. And sometimes I'll just say, look, this is something that's an internal thing and we want to discuss it. And you do that, too. You respect them for those things, too, on occasion. You know, there's you know, you judge what the worth of that is. But I'm never going to put in a position. Like I said, I don't work for them.
Right.
You know, I work for Crescent City Sports. So my job is to make sure that I do right by Crescent City Sports and by the people who read it. I'm always going to be fair to the team, but I don't work for them. I'm not their PR machine. So
right. Yeah. Yeah. And if they were to ask you to be part of their media team or something like that, I'm just curious, is that something you would be interested in, or you don't know?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, you know, there's a consistency, of course, that and being part of a franchise is something. Yeah, I mean, like, oh yeah, I'm part of an NBA franchise. I get to work with some of the greatest athletes in the world on a daily basis. But then at the same time, I just don't know their side is very political.
Right.
There's a lot to navigate between the front office, the coaching staff, and the players and the media. And how do you make sure that everybody's happy?
Yeah.
Or everybody's not unhappy.
Right. Yeah. That's yes, that.
And so that part.
Right.
You know, maybe on a lower level, it might be more interesting actually to me. Like to be in the G League and have that responsibility.
Sure.
Because I think then it becomes a lot more about, there are a lot more stories about promoting individual players because all these guys are trying to make it to the next level. Yeah. It's a lot more community based. The money is, you know, not as big an issue, obviously. And you have coaching stories that you're not, and access to those coaches that you normally wouldn't get because they're always trying to sell their product in that market.
Right.
So, I mean, that might be a lot more interesting to me on a smaller scale mm-hmm. than doing it at the NBA level where it feels like you're stuck in a lot of ways into a very tight vise mm-hmm. of what you can and cannot do.
Tell me a little bit more about your work for the LSU, for the football, the LSU football stuff.
Right. So
go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. LSU, you know, football is king in the South, and in no state is one school more important to its state than LSU. You know, in every other state in the South outside of Arkansas, but you know, there are at least two major programs.
Yeah.
You know, Mississippi and Mississippi State, Bama and Auburn, Florida State and Miami, you know, Georgia Tech.
Yeah.
Everybody has two programs.
Yeah.
But that's LSU doesn't have that. So everything is about LSU here in Louisiana. So it's gonna be a tough year for them. I mean, you know, their schedule is the hardest in the country amongst Power Five teams. Mm. They play at least three top 10 teams, possibly four. You know, they start the season with Miami. They have Bama and Georgia and back-to-back games over a three-week period. And they have Florida. They play Auburn. They play. I mean, it's a really tough schedule for them. And Orgeron, there are people who love him. You know, he's obviously as Louisiana as it gets. A lot of people call him Farmer Fran. You know. But he's a really nice gentleman. There has been a shift in that program since he got there, and Les Miles left. It's been a lot more accessible. It's been a lot more upbeat. He doesn't, you know, I'll say this about Les Miles, and, you know, Les Miles is a Michigan man, you know, so I treat Michigan guys well, but Les Miles was a jerk. And I'm just gonna flat out say that because he thought he was smarter than everybody.
Yeah,
and. You know, and any coach who acts that way, I just don't, you know, dude, you don't have to be that way because that's not what I'm here for.
Right.
I'm not here to outsmart you, coach. Yeah. I'm here to write a story. So just give me a decent answer.
Yeah.
You know? And so it would get to be a lot of times where there was a game they played his last season where they played Jacksonville State, which is a bowl championship division school, right. I mean, where we used to call 1AA,
right.
And LSU almost lost to them, beat them 17-13. Mm-hmm. And after the game, like, coach, your defense did not hold them to a three and out until 2 minutes to go in the first half. I said, this is a lower division school. How does that happen? He's, they have All Americans over there. Yeah, lower division All Americans.
Yes.
You're LSU. You're supposed to be talking about beating Alabama.
Right.
Not Jacksonville State of Alabama. You know, and you struggled to do that. And, you know, so he was boosting this team that was not going to have anybody go to the NFL, and he had a team that had 9 guys drafted.
Yeah.
So you shouldn't be at home. You that shouldn't happen. But Orgeron is not that kind of guy. So over the last year and a half, it's been a lot more accessible. But LSU football is its own unique – monster, and it is tough being a black reporter at LSU games, because there's still a hierarchy, and there's a way that I've experienced on occasion some things directed in my direction in the press box that, you know, I just didn't find enjoyable. And then when I looked around, I noticed I'm the only one like me, you know. And I'm trying to watch the field, but when people say things to you or, you know, ask to see your press pass again and again and again, you know, it's just but I'm sure those things happen at Alabama. I'm sure they happen at Auburn or whatever. But, you know, this is where I live, so it's kind of tough. It's like I've been doing this for 4 years now.
Yeah.
You know, the same people work there.
Right.
There's some people there who treat me really well, and I never would paint a broad picture like that. But, you know, you'll hear the word the N-word fly a few times at an LSU game. It'll rise up from the stands every once in a while when a kid fumbles a ball or doesn't make a play. And that's just disheartening, man. And, you know, it's like it's just the kids.
Right.
It's bad enough that you're saying it, but you're saying it to kids. Guys who don't come here to fail. They're not those kids. None of those kids want to be out there and fail.
Right.
And, you know, so I, but it can be tough. But again, I love telling stories. I love meeting people.
Yeah.
And you do meet really interesting young men, and who have stories that you can't imagine sometimes, and other ones that are just as universal as can be. And those are important too.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of times in sports, we do dehumanize the athlete.
Right.
We make them commodities, mm-hmm. Instead of people. And these are fully rounded individuals, and we should know them. Because when things happen to them, when there are labor disputes, when there are injury concerns, you know, we have to remember that these are people, and they're not just that things we see on TV,
right.
Or people you go to the arena and watch them, you know, hurt themselves for our entertainment.
Right. They have families. They have bills.
They have
all the things that you have.
And that kid's got to go, you know, he drops a touchdown pass and they lose. He's got to go to class on Monday.
Right, yeah.
And he's got to be talked about on the radio. And he's got to have it in the school newspaper. And everywhere he walks, somebody's like, man, why couldn't you catch that?
Right.
If you flunk your, you know, midterm, you're not walking up and down the halls of your campus and you're going, man, how'd you drop that test, man? That was easy. We all knew that test.
Right.
Yeah. Nothing happened to you, so.
Yeah. I remember you said, or you posted, you didn't put a picture of it, but you wrote something once about, this goes back to you being the only black man, person of color in the boot, in the press box, but you were saying you were walking around the, you know, the tailgating area, I think, and you're like, and you're talking about the placement of flags.
Yeah, there were, you know, Trump flags were higher than the American flag on some poles, Confederate LSU flags, you know, those types of things, and they're right along the strip on the campus.
Yeah.
This isn't out on private property or, you know, this is the campus that everybody in the state pays for.
Yeah.
And, man, I don't want to see that. You know, I just don't. I don't, it makes me uncomfortable to walk into that space.
Yeah.
And, look, I understand the world is not going to always be comfortable. But in that space on a college campus that I help pay for with my taxes,
yeah,
I shouldn't have to feel unwelcome. Right. Or I shouldn't have to feel like there are spots that I can't walk on that campus. And, you know, I mean, we had those things on our campus. We had those back in the day, and they're everywhere.
Yeah.
But it's just when you see it in these large numbers and you know why it's there. It's not there to celebrate anything because it has nothing to do with what you're doing.
Right.
You came to watch a football game.
Yeah.
So why are you showing this other than to provoke people? Right. You want people to see it. You want them to say something about it. You want them to feel some way about it.
Yeah.
And you can't then turn around and say that you don't want to see people kneeling at games. You can't turn around and say you don't want to see, you know, any types of protest at sporting events because you're making political statements out in your car while people are driving to there and they didn't come to see that either.
Right.
Yeah. And what yours is about is simple defiance.
Right.
That's all you're being. You're just being publicly defiant and saying I can do this because I can.
Yeah.
Whereas other people are out there trying to actually draw attention to an issue that is not, again, a color issue as far as I'm concerned. It's an American issue that specifically deals with one ethnicity. But we're all – every American should be concerned anytime police officers are killing American citizens. And so if you want to compare those two, yeah, we can't. That's a non-starter.
Right. Yeah. Or the inability or the decision just to not even try to understand that that's – what is being protested.
Right. Just the simple choice of just saying no.
Choice, yeah. Tell me about going to the National Association of Black Journalists conventions that you've gone to, about that experience.
Yeah, those have been amazing for me. And I know that, you know, every year
I'm sorry to interrupt, but give a little bit more about what the idea of that conference is.
Okay, so the National Association of Black Journalists has three components, essentially. There are task forces in different areas. There's a sports task force, task force that's just related to the news, and I forget the third right now, but there's a lot of the task force, you know, they address issues for African Americans in those fields. How do we get more opportunities? Where are the jobs? How do we connect people? What's the next wave of thing that's coming? So those conversations are constantly happening, and there's seminars and things like that. The second part is that it is a job reference tool. It is an opportunity for us to meet with major companies at the convention, you know, Wall Street Journal, Fox Media, NBC, all those companies are there, as well as a huge number of, you know, other media companies that do public relations or public radio or advertising. They're all there too, because it extends beyond just traditional journalism. You know, productions people are there, all those types of things. Educational opportunities for people, you know, those types of things. So, you know, there's this huge, huge job fair areas and things like that. It's also opportunities for people to network, of course, by field or by region. And then you have a lot of sessions, you know, breakout sessions based on your area of interest. And also sometimes it's just based on, you know, some of them are by invite only and you have to register for them. And then other ones are open to anybody. So, you know, I've done good ones about podcasting or how to write, you know, better for the internet, how you generate revenue for yourself, those types of things. But more than anything, it's an opportunity to see that you're not running through this struggle by yourself. Like, you leave there energized in a way that you weren't when you came in. Because we've all been, like, in any profession, sometimes it's good just to be around the people in your field who understand your story. And you can, in that elevator, going up to the next meeting, you say, hey, where are you from? What do you cover? Oh, okay, I do that too. What's your station like? Oh, yeah, I've done that. Yeah, I've been there.
Yeah.
And that connection then leads to that exchange of business cards, and I never know when I may need you, you know, or when we just want to talk, or if you're in town, if you want to go have dinner. And it's meant so much to me, and I've met so many people through there, people who I've admired, and then also people who are already starting to come to me in some regards and say, hey, how do I do this? So to have that opportunity to impart whatever wisdom I have to the next generation of journalists is, you know, awesome. It's something I never even thought about. And then to be able to have access to the greatest minds, you know, in my field, to be able to talk to a William Roten, to be able to talk to LZ Granderson, Bomani Jones, Jemele Hill, you know, just to pick their minds and to have them tell you, yeah, this is what you need to do. Talk to Jamila Lemieux, who was the editor-in-chief at Ebony Magazine. You know, she and I had a conversation. And then you start just meeting the peripheral people. You know, that's where I met Earl Monroe. That's where I met Charles Barkley. That's where I met Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, because they were being honored or were part of panels. And it's just to be amongst all of that, when you leave, you feel like, okay, I can go out and try some more. You know, whatever I was doing, it's not enough. How can I amp it up, do some more, and so that next year when I come back, I got a better story to tell, and I'm in a better place, and, you know, I can help somebody else. So, yeah, I love them. The first one I went to, I was like, okay, my eyes were literally just wide open for 3 straight days. Just, I couldn't taking it all in. Mm-hmm. And then by the second one, then you're like, now I know how to do this. I know, you know, where to go, how to enjoy it, how to plan it. And it was much more fun. And it was in New Orleans last year. So then I became like a de facto tour guide, of course, for people who I knew. And it was just, this year it's in Detroit. So it's like it's doing a tour of all my old places.
Mm-hmm. But. That's great. Was the first year like, holy shit, but money, like, were you like, ah, like, oh my god, like, like a little bit of.
The first guy that I did that over was Rembert Brown.
Mm, yeah.
And, you know, Rembert was huge with Grantland, mm-hmm. and has written some amazing pieces completely unrelated to sports, just mm-hmm. about America in general. I mean, he's just a fantastic writer.
Yep.
And he and I were in line at the bookstore, mm-hmm. At the convention. And I was like, hey, you remember Brown, right? And he's like, yeah. They're all, you know, it's not like, I don't know why I said that, because of course he's remember Brown.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? You know what he looks like.
Yeah, yeah.
If I run into Magic Johnson, I'm not going to be like, hey, Magic Johnson.
Right, yeah. I think I actually think he would take that okay, but yeah.
Magic, he'd be like, yes, right, I'm Magic.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I am Magic. Yeah, you're so Magic. Imagine.
Yeah, yeah. So, right.
But, yeah, so we just started talking, and He gives me his phone number right then and there. He's like, here, this is my cell. Call me.
Yeah.
And you know, like, that was easy. You know, like, wow. Okay. Right.
Yeah.
And you know, like kind of through the week, you know, I met Jay at Donde and I got to talk to him. And you know, like it takes a minute. It always takes me a minute because I'm like just, let me just get myself together, make sure I'm cool, that I don't go fanboy over here.
Mm-hmm.
And let me have a legitimate question ready.
Right.
You know, so if I'm going to go over and talk to him, I'm not going to waste this opportunity. I may only get one. Let me get it.
Yeah.
And so I talked to him about some stuff and Rob Parker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I used Detroit as my entree in there with him because, you know, I spent a lot of time there.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's it. Yeah, Bomani. And yeah, my picture with Bomani is photobombed by Rembert. You know, that was a funny night. You know, and then, you know, getting to meet Jermell Hill and of course, Michael Smith,
yep.
Who knows a friend of mine. So, you know, and he's from New Orleans and went to Brother Martin High School. So, you know, there's only six, you know, fewer than 6 degrees of separation for me to get to know him.
Yeah.
And it was great. You know, none of them gave you the impression that they wouldn't talk to you.
Yeah.
But they weren't going to have their time wasted.
Right.
You know, that's always the case with people who are, and I understand that. If I were at that level, it's like, don't come over here and just, you know, pass out in front of me.
Right.
You know, I'm a person. You know, let's just do that.
Right.
Have a conversation, so.
Gotcha.
It's always intimidating for me for the first 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah.
Because I don't view myself as very important in the grand scheme of sports media. So, somebody to be like, hey, you made a good point. You know, thank you. Like, you yeah. know, like, certain interviews that I've done with people, like Spencer Haywood.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, interviewing him, you know, number one draft pick.
Mm-hmm.
Most scored, I think, still for the longest time, had the single game record for points scored in an Olympic game for the United States.
Mm.
You know, just the guy who basically created the early entry rule.
Right.
So, you know, we talked to him on the radio, me and my friend Roe Brown, who I work with a lot, and you know, I remember asking him a couple of questions about how what his place in the NBA was like now, and why didn't the league embrace him a little bit more, and you know, he's like, because I cost him a lot of money.
Yeah.
He's like, everybody in the league basically owes me 10%. Every player in there should pay me 10% because none of them would have been in there.
Right, yeah.
If it wasn't. And he was just a really nice guy in Athens. And then what's interesting is 2 years later, I meet his daughter, who's a reporter at NABJ. And I mean, she was just the coolest person, too. She was just as kind and funny as her father. So it was just, you know, there's just those times when it's like, I'm just a fan, but I have to rein it in. And do my job.
What shows up now a lot is you'll post your TV spots. So you're doing like the TV spots, the radio, and the podcasting, which I'm just waiting for your show to. I know you're gonna start doing your own podcast soon. It has to happen.
Yeah, so, it's coming.
Okay,
it's
good. Coming.
We're getting the equipment together and everything.
Awesome.
And so like I'm supposed to be creative director and host.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, we're talking about me doing two different shows.
Okay.
That one would be sports-centric.
Mm-hmm.
Just very hardcore in that regard, just straight up and down sports, you know, the way I do it.
Yeah, yeah.
But then the other would be me giving more broad takes on things in general. Like more of an Olbermann in that type of... You know, not persona, obviously, because there's only one Keith Olbermann. Right. Thank God. You know, yeah, thank God there's only one.
Yeah.
But but along those lines, be able to touch on whatever I want to talk about.
Right.
And have more of a bigger variety of guests that I talk to. And to challenge myself and challenge ideas.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people just be like, David, man, you have so many opinions on so many things. And so, you know, I'd love to hear some of them, you know, more often.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it'll be an interesting experiment for me to see, you know, what can I do in that room?
Yeah. Yeah, it's fun. The thing I enjoy, or it's, I wonder what it's like, is when you're doing the TV spots, and there's like three of you on this one tiny couch, it looks like, and you're just sitting, like, you have to sit there, it looks like don't move, like, don't be, like, wait for the guy to finish, because your turn is coming. I don't know, it's just... It is fun. The setup is just, I just enjoy just watching you just be like, okay, and then finally you get to talk.
Sometimes it's like that, depending on who I'm sitting with.
Yeah.
Certain guys that, when they start going, yeah, elevator music starts playing in my head. And then I hear the bing, and I step up. Time to go. Yeah, I mean, there's certain guys that I really don't like. Even if I like them, that I don't respect their basketball opinions.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the nature of the beast. I know that there are people who don't respect mine.
Yeah.
If you did, you know, anything that you do in public, and you absolutely know that, it's like anything you do in front of people or that people are going to consume.
Yeah,
you're subject to ridicule, and you're subject to people just not liking it. So
yeah,
that if that bothers you, then don't, you can't ever be out there.
Right. Yeah. I mean, do you find yourself, is that getting more, just generally speaking, comfortable for you to do those, to you know, float around in all those different media outposts?
Yeah. I enjoy it more and more because it's starting to become regular. There's a routine starting to develop. And that makes me comfortable. You know, I know the hosts enough to know when things are going to happen, when they're going to reach out to me, and I'm in control of when I get to speak. So if they say, hey, can you do Tuesday? I can say, no, I'll only do Wednesday this week. You know, I have that ability now to choose when I want to do it. And before I was so actively just, I needed time that I would take everybody's requests.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were days that I'd do four in a day, and by the fourth one, my voice was shot.
Right.
And, you know, and I'd said the same thing four different ways. Mm-hmm. The best I could. So, yeah, now I get to be a lot more choosy, and I get to build relationships that are more consistent with certain people.
Mm-hmm.
I get to not have to go on some of the programs that I knew didn't have bigger audiences, because my audience is following and growing with me to other places. So that's really cool.
Yeah. Have you figured out how to protect your own physical voice while doing these different media appearances? Or are you still working on that? Is that still a work in progress?
I can't drink cold stuff anymore before I speak.
Mm.
So I drink a lot of temperature stuff.
Okay.
Because cold messes me up. It tightens my vocal cords really quickly.
Mm.
So I never bring cold drinks. And if people offer me soda, you know, when I sit down at a place, I'm like, no, can you give me the small bottle of water? Because I'm going to go through a bunch of the small ones.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want the big one. Because once its weight is off, and I'm sticking it underneath the table again, I knock things over. Give me a small one. We get to a break, boom, small one.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Great. No, like, or give me a mug. They're giving me the mugs now. I'm like, yeah, give me a mug.
Mm-hmm.
I can't drink cold water. It just really messes me up.
Mm. Do you do like?
And I don't do mornings. I don't like to do mornings.
Mm.
My voice usually doesn't get into its good rhythm until about 11.
Yeah. Do you what about like tea? Can you do that, or do you do that?
I hate hot drinks.
Oh, okay.
Eat hot drinks.
Okay.
And my wife's telling me to drink tea, and like, I just, if it's not winter, I'm not drinking your hot drink. Just not. Keep your tea away from me. Yeah.
And winter in Louisiana, not really.
I do buy these on little sticks of honey.
Mm-hmm.
That are like maybe like 8 inches long, and they're real narrow.
Yeah.
And you can, and I just cut the tops off, and I'll sip on honey on occasion, because that does help too.
Okay.
Like and it tastes good. So, you know, hey, why not? But so yeah, the honey is good for my throat. So that's my combination now. Mm-hmm. But I catch colds so often.
Oh yeah.
And that, man, I have bad. Like I just had a bout with sinusitis. And that was my second one this summer. Mm. And I couldn't do any interviews for a week. So, yeah, when I get sick, that's why I'm glad my primary thing is writing. And I'm glad I can, with the radio, you know, again, if I tell them I can't do it today, give me another day.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, but it's much easier to write on voice to write than it is to speak if people don't know that.
Yeah. All right, time for random ask questions. Finally doing this with you.
Okay.
Don't get your hopes up. That's all I'm saying. All right. What is, and maybe something we haven't talked about yet, but what is something within your job, your field, that most gets under your skin or drives you the most nuts?
Okay. There are two.
Okay.
One is a serious one and one is more human.
Okay.
Yeah, the first thing that bothers me about my job is that how much just the disparity there is in a city like New Orleans and Baton Rouge, that both of them are majority African-American and there's not a single African-American on radio doing sports on a daily basis. And there's only one show hosted by an African-American on a weekly basis in those two cities. That's my number one pain in the butt because I contacted all those stations about opportunities and then never even gotten a call back. Mm. But the more humorous one is just, the thing that's annoying are the people who think that they're really important among reporters, who believe that their time is the most important time. Okay. And so they will ask a question that is stupid, and then to ask another follow-up question, while the rest of us would like to move on from your stupid question. And you'd hog up the time.
Uh-huh.
Because I know the coach is not going to take but more than 5 or 6 questions before he's done.
Right.
You know, I got to get him in. And this idiot wants to keep asking questions. That means nothing. He's one of those, they're the kind of reporters who ask questions like, how did the wind feel?
Like
that is the most worthless question, you know? Those are worthless.
Right.
You want situational questions. You want adjustment questions. You want those. Those are the answers that you want to give people. They will tell you it felt great to get the win.
Yeah.
The player will give you that. That's the easiest thing to get from someone.
Right, yeah.
But that guy always goes first.
Yeah.
We'll say I saw this poor kid. I hate saying kid because he's a grown man.
Yeah.
But to me, I mean, you know, he looked like a kid.
Right.
From NBA China.
Uh-huh.
He's in the locker room, and on two different occasions, I saw DeMarcus Cousins just destroy this kid. The first one was last year when he got traded to the Pelicans. Me and another reporter said if you met, he was walking around with the wireless earbuds when they just come out.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he was like, "Y'all got these?" I was like, "Man, do you know we get paid? I don't have any Apple earbuds."
Right, right.
He said, "Well, if we make the playoffs, I'm buying one for everybody in the media. I'm buying a pair for everybody in the media." So we're like, "Cool. All right, that's great." Well, they didn't make the playoffs. So when the season opened up at our first day of training camp, he said, "Hey, DeMarcus, if y'all make it this year, are you going to get the earbuds?" And he said, "Yeah. How many people do I have to take care of?" So we're like, we're in the locker room later in the season, and we're like, you know, and I was like, "You know, we're just kidding about the earbuds." He's like, no, I said it. I'm going to get the earbuds and we make the playoffs. And he said, "But I'm only giving you the ones I know." And he starts going around. He's like, "I know him. I know you. I know you. Who are you? I know you. You ain't getting one." That was the first time he ripped that kid. The second one was, the kid asked him a question about all-star voting, about how important all-star voting was to him. And he looked at him and he's like, "You really think I give a fuck about all-star voting?" He said he was talking about All-Star Gold. Who are you, man? And it's like, no, it's the same guy. You know who he is.
Yeah.
I mean, he would just get torn up. And I felt bad for him. So I don't, that's always rough for them when a player rips into a guy who's just doing his job. But I don't feel bad for the guys who are doing a bad job and they get torn up.
Right.
So they're the worst. The guys who are really self-important.
Yeah. Who think they're doing the Lord's work.
No. Yes. they're the next, you know, Pulitzer Prize winner.
Right.
Or, you know, they're going to get a local Emmy for this. Mm-hmm. Not because of the 97-94 win in November, dude.
Yes.
This is not put on the reel. It's not. Let it go.
Has anyone ever nailed an impression of you? And if so, how did they do it?
One of the reporters does one because I had been voted basically both the leader of the cool kid table amongst the sports reporters, but also the loudest person in the history of the media there. And so occasionally they will mock me about how I talk during the games.
Mm.
And they will do the things that I say, and they'll say them very loudly. They don't get my voice down perfectly, but they know what I say, and they say it loudly. And so I give them credit for that. And they've hit me in print a couple of times too. You know, joke. It's all jokes, and because we laugh about it, and I embrace it.
Yeah.
They hit me in print a couple of times, because somebody asked the guy the writer, and he said, "Hey, why don't you sit down by the cool kids table?" Because he sits by the traditional media side, and I'm on the non-traditional side.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, "I don't have to worry about that because I can hear Grubb from down there anyway." And it's like, so,
you know me.
What am I supposed to say?
Right. Yeah. Like,
not lying. I mean, so. But I love it. I'm glad that there is that kind of camaraderie amongst a lot of us. We are able to joke with each other. We do a meet up outside of the game sometimes, and we do, you know, talk to each other, you know, via email or text message, because you know, we know that the market needs to grow.
Yeah.
And New Orleans can be a basketball town. I think. No, they've got to win. I mean, that's right. It. The key to anything is they don't have enough history to not be winning.
Right.
But I think New Orleans wants to learn. New Orleans is not just not very educated right now about basketball. It used to be a really good basketball city.
Mm-hmm.
And then after Katrina, a lot of those people never came back who loved it and were part of New Orleans basketball in a big way. So you're kind of rebuilding the whole culture of basketball in Southeast Louisiana.
Gotcha. All right, what is the most impractical item of clothing you own?
It'd probably be all the old jerseys that I have in a box that I'll never be able to fit into again. But that I just keep because I just can't let them go.
Yeah.
But I'm never going to fit into those things again. And I have them, and I would love one day to be able to put one of them back on.
Uh-huh.
It ain't gonna happen.
It's just gonna rip.
I went from 42 to 38, so I've lost a good amount of weight lately.
Yeah, great. Congratulations.
Even if I graduated high school as a 36.
Mm-hmm.
So even I'd have to be down like my eighth grade weight. You know what I mean? That ain't happening at 42. Unless I just like start taking math. Or something like mm-hmm. that. I'm not prepared for that. I'm not prepared for that. I've never seen a happy ending meth story, so.
That's true. Yeah. You can get a lot done, from what I've been told, at the early part. You can be very productive. It's like cocaine, I've heard. Same thing. You can be very productive in the beginning.
And then it's meth.
And then, yeah, exactly. And then...
Your teeth fall out and age about 30 years in a mm-hmm. week.
Yeah.
I'll pass.
Yes. But I get it. I get it. That's all I'm saying.
I mean, it does what it's supposed to do.
Yes.
It's not false advertising.
No.
You know? Exactly. So at least it has that going for it.
Right. Got it. All right. What is a great movie and what is a terrible movie?
You know what is a terrible movie? And I keep telling people it's a terrible movie and no one ever listens to me is Inception. Inception is a terrible
movie. Hot take. Hot take.
Terrible.
Why?
Because I hate it when Christopher Nolan focuses so much on how the movie looks and leaves plot holes the size of dinosaurs all through the movie. You know, it's just ridiculous amounts of plot holes in that movie. He changes his own rules within the movie. And my wife will tell you, the moment we stepped out of the theater, I said, that was bullshit. She's like, what? It was good. And I was like, no, it's bullshit. I hated it. I hated that whole thing. Like, he thinks he's better than me. Like, I'm turning into, like, an Italian father from a bad sitcom. You think you're better than me, Christopher Nolan? You think you can make movies that trick me? You're not tricking me, Christopher Nolan. That's how I was at that point. You're not getting one over on me, Christopher Nolan. I saw The Dark Knight. I saw that.
Yeah.
Which I also have problems with. I really have problems with The Dark Knight Rises. I mean, that just... All sense of reality is destroyed in The Dark Knight Rises. Just, it's all gone. Makes no sense. It makes no sense! Now, it's a really good movie. You know, Chevy Chase has become so synonymous with only the vacation movies. And I think a movie that's really good that people don't talk about and love as much as maybe a small subset of people is Spies Like Us.
Yes! It's been I need to watch it again. But yeah, I love that movie growing up.
That movie is so good.
Yeah.
It's just tremendous. And it's Chevy Chase as he was intended to be. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, all the things that you like about him. That, and it's around that same time that he made Fletch and everything, too.
Another classic.
Love it, yes. But he's in that zone. He's in his zone.
Yeah.
And he's just killing it.
Yeah.
And I love that movie. I love Spies Like Us. I love it. And I think, I don't understand when people say they haven't seen it or they don't like it. What's not to like? Soulfinger. They play Soulfinger in the middle of the Soviet...
I always do. I don't know that a lot of people understand what I'm referencing, but frequently I like particularly when I go to conferences and someone has just like finished their doctorate, I just want I'm like doctor, and we do the doctor thing back and forth. And I don't think they know where it's from. I'm like, it's from Spies Like Us. It's when they all enter the tent. And they're like, doctor, 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 doctor. It's the best.
And then they do it again when they leave.
Yeah.
I love it. It's awesome.
Oh, that's a good one. Now I have to watch that again. It's been too long.
The Road to Dushanbe. Road to Dushanbe.
First, we must.
Emmett Fitzhugh.
First, we must shave the patient.
What we do not understand.
Yeah.
And now the first incision.
Yeah. That's so good. Nice. All right. Where is somewhere that you have not traveled to that you still want to get to?
Pacific Coast. I've never been to the Pacific Coast. I really would like to, especially the Northwest part of it.
Yeah.
I would really like to experience that. as far as domestic.
Yeah.
International, I really want to visit Greece, Italy.
Yeah.
Santorini, those kind of places. Mm-hmm. For some reason, water has been very interesting to me lately. I want to be around some water.
Yeah. Yeah. For someone who's been to Italy recently, yeah. Get to Italy. You will love it. And not just because the food is unbelievable. I mean, but the views and the water and everything is tremendous. And
you know what really started making me excited to want to go to Italy was watching the second season of Master of None.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
And you're just like, man, that life just looks...
Yeah.
Incredibly just, yes.
Yeah, yeah. I'm in all of it.
Yeah. Riding a bike.
Yeah.
Having a good day, doing your job.
Yeah.
Everything's cool.
Yeah, a 2 to 3 hour dinner. Just go for it. Get an aperitif, a pre-dinner drink that everyone does. Get up, get a cap. You don't like hot drinks, but you get the cappuccino or you get the gelato, which is even better.
Tiramisu.
Yeah. So good. What is your favorite Michael Jackson song? This is an important question. I ask it of pretty much all my guests.
Okay. And we're only talking solo, Michael.
Oh, no, it doesn't. We don't have to. You can expand.
It's hard for me not to go with Human Nature.
Oh, I've had a few of those recently.
Don't Stop Till You Get Enough is a revolutionary song.
Yeah.
In music history. And the whole Off the Wall album is my favorite Michael Jackson album.
It's the best.
Because it is not a disco album, even though I like disco music. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of disco music that I enjoy.
Yeah.
But I think it is the bridge from the late 70s disco into 80s R&B pop. Mm-hmm. Like, that album is the sound of pop was going to be like. That mix of live instrumentation with synthesizers.
Yeah.
And that feel of the urban beat underneath it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where that came from, was that moment. I mean, think about it, too, the guys who put it together.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm so much is that Rod Temperton, a white guy, takes care of the lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have Quincy Jones, who was raised as a big band guy.
Yeah.
And, this big orchestral sound of his, mm-hmm. and he brings that down for popular music.
Yeah.
And then who's run the gamut of soul music.
Right.
And started in the disco part as a performer with his brothers and his unique vocal style.
Mm-hmm.
And all comes together and it just makes this, like I said, I think it was a revolutionary album. Whereas Thriller to me is not revolutionary. It's a great album, but there are two songs that I would kick right off the album. And you know what they are.
The Girl's Mine?
Yes, that is absolutely
that one's out. And
The Girl is it's a terrible song.
And the other one?
And the other one would probably be, what's the one? It's another ballad. No, not the ballad. What's the name? Baby Be Mine. That can go. It just doesn't work. Doesn't work for me. But other than that, and then the song Thriller itself, no one plays it to play it. It's not a song you'd be like, hey, put on Thriller.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? You're like, nobody's ever been like, I'm going jogging, I got Thriller in my shuffle.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh. It has no purpose other than as a novelty now. And the video.
Right.
But it's not a song. I mean, Vincent Price is the most enjoyable part of that song.
Yeah.
And we should revisit, too, how problematic that video is.
Oh.
Because Michael Jackson does a lot of terrible things in that video. And I don't know how he had a girlfriend in the first place. Because there's no way that girl should have been dating the way he treated her on that date.
Oh, it's
just awful.
Yeah.
From the movie on. And she's like, I can't take this. I'm very scared. He doesn't say, you know what? Hey, I'm your man. Let's go. You're right. Let's go. And then they leave, and he walks her down the filthiest, dirtiest part of town. Doesn't get a bus, no cab, nothing.
Yeah.
The filthiest, dirtiest part of town. He takes it down the street in the middle of the night because no one else is there.
Yeah.
What the hell is his problem? He's a terrible boyfriend.
Wow.
Michael is not good. Look, his relationships with women in videos, outside of keeping in the closet,
right?
They're all problematic. Remember the time he's out there stealing Eddie Murphy's woman?
Mm-hmm.
Iman, again, this is weird. See, this is what my bipolar brain is doing, and this is what happened.
Uh-huh.
Iman played Jermaine Jackson's love interest in the video Do What You Do, and then played Michael's love interest in Remember the Time. How weird is that?
I hadn't thought of it. That's pretty crazy. And then she married David Bowie, like, right around that time, I think, right?
Yep. So how many women can say that they played the love interest of both Jermaine and Michael Jackson? Not many. She tried to shoot Jermaine in that video, if you've never seen it.
I'll have to YouTube that and figure it.
Yeah, he plays a mafia boss. You have to see it. It's with his Jerry curl.
Of course.
You know. Yep. It's a ballad, and she tries to kill him. It's, yeah.
Oh, I like the song. I just haven't. I can't recall the video.
Yeah.
Well, and we're not even getting into the fact that Michael Jackson sings the hook on the Somebody's Watching Me song. So we're not even cutting to that part.
And he sang the hook on the other song that was released from that album, Obscene Phone Caller. He wrote those because Barry Gordy asked him to do it. Mm. He's like, that's my son. I need some help with this boy.
Yeah.
Michael would keep a lot of favors, man. I mean, he was putting people on left and right. You know, he gave let Janet LaToya sing on PYT.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I know Randy sang some backup for him when he was solo.
Yeah.
So, they're giving you some checks. Yeah. Let's hand out a check.
All right.
He let LaToya say, say, say video as his love interest.
Oh, God. Man.
Your brain went back, and you're like, he's right. That's weird.
Yeah.
That's SAG check.
All right. What is your biggest kitchen mess up?
Of all time?
Sure.
I was at my parents' house, about 13 years old,
mm-hmm.
and we had guests. Who were in from Germany. They were friends of my parents' friends.
Okay.
And they were passing through the United States, and they were going to stay with us for a couple of nights till they got, you know, were headed on their next destination. So my parents told me to make them breakfast.
Okay.
Like, I can make bacon and eggs, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
Cook bacon, smoke alarm goes off. Then I made scrambled eggs, but I forgot to drain the pan of the grease from the bacon.
Mm-hmm.
I made the scrambled eggs. So they may have been the most disgusting scrambled eggs made in the history of mankind. And those poor people, not to hurt my feelings, shoveled that shit down their throats. So. That was bad.
Yeah.
I could have poisoned them. I could have started an international incident. I'll never forget that one.
Oh, that is great.
Because my dad comes over, he's like, what the hell happened? Because the pan is all messed up.
Right.
And I'm like, I forgot to drain the grease.
Oh. All right, what was your worst job growing up?
summer camp counselor at St. Andrew's Day Camp. Because I didn't really have bad summer jobs. You know, like, after that, when I was a kid, it was, you know, I worked at Chuck E. Cheese. Chuck E. Cheese wasn't that bad because all my friends worked there. Mm-hmm. But St. Andrew's was bad. Just, kids were, they were all really privileged kids. And they were kind of just didn't want to listen, stuck up, just... Yeah, I lasted like 4 weeks, and I was like, yeah, this ain't for me. You know, it was like 8 week camp, and I was like, 4 weeks, yeah, I don't want to do that. When I was 15, my first job, yeah, that one didn't work. But none of the other ones, you know, most of the other stuff was either, you know, service industry, stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know? And that would be that really growing up. Like, as an adult, my worst job was at Southern University in New Orleans. That was the worst job I've ever had as an adult. That one literally almost killed me. It literally almost killed me. Like, that's how stressful that job was. Mm. It gave me permanent arthritis in my neck. There was a toxic area, and four professors have died who worked in the building.
Oh,
and I did twice without a face mask, and I wasn't told that I was in danger. Because I was taken in there by the campus facilities people. And the next day, I had a swelling on my arm that was about 11 inches long and 4 inches wide. And the doctor had to measure it because he hadn't seen something I've had on somebody's arm before.
Oh my
and he
God.
couldn't diagnose it either. So they gave me like a shot and some other stuff and told me like to just ride it out. And it went away. But I know that it was from that. And then I also had to get my heart tested because I was having chest pains on a daily basis. And they said, you're not having a heart attack, you just have stress. So the job was, like, actually killing me. I have to leave. I got to go. And so I was like, I got to quit this thing. It's too much.
Oh, it's bad. All right, and lastly, what one piece of art... We'll make it. It could be music, movies, books, podcasts, YouTube clips, theater, visual art, whatever has impacted you the most recently.
You know, something that's had a big impact on me is this show called Pose.
Mm.
That just FX.
I haven't seen it. I'm familiar. I've heard of it.
And you know, obviously, it's a door into a community that I'm not familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never met. You know, I've met. You know, transsexual people. I met gays. I met lesbians. It's not that, but I don't know that world.
Yeah,
it's a glimpse into that world, and you see the unique parts of it. But what's more important to me is that you see the versatility of all of it. That at the end of it, and just like most things in this world, our wants and desires as human beings are consistent, and the rest of it is just the things that make us unique as people, but our essential essence is essential essence. That's redundant. Our essence is just the same things. We all want to belong. We all want to be respected. We all want to be loved. We want to have value in the world, and you want to have friends, and you want to not just be loved as a person, but have romantic love as well.
Yeah.
That it's so well written, it's so well acted, it doesn't feel acted, it doesn't feel false. It looks really good. It's shot very well. And so in all the ways that I would want someone to tell me a good story, it's doing that, it's fulfilling that. And it's compelling, and it's emotional, and there's a sadness, and there's also great joy to it. And so anything that makes me go through that gamut of emotions, but it's in a non-manipulative manner.
Yeah.
Then I really enjoy those types of things.
So great to catch up with David for the third time on this podcast. I really enjoy talking with him wherever he is. And I look forward to all of his writing and his soon-to-becoming podcast career. I know it's happening, so stay tuned. This week's rave And in keeping with the sports theme show is the HBO series Hard Knocks. I'm sure I've raved about it in the past, but this season just ended, and it's always a great time every year. This year's entry in Hard Knocks was the Cleveland Browns, owners of a tie for the worst record in NFL history last year, 0-16, and they've won four games in the last three seasons. Really bad. There's lots to recommend here, as usual. The current season featured the exploits of head coach Hugh Jackson, who went through an awful situation at the beginning of the show of losing a brother and his mother within 10 days, but bounced back to coach without any real break. It included the constant bickering, yelling, and swearing of assistant coaches Todd Haley and Greg Williams, two men who have long, checkered coaching histories, look it up, and who find really, really, really creative ways of swearing. I mean, in ways that required a rewatch and applause often. It's truly a talent. You know, if you're going to swear, I just ask for some creativity. That's all. The true MVP was the recent signee Jarvis Landry, a wide receiver of an incredible talent who's also a little bit out there. He likes to say bless him to those he plays against, which no one really knows what it means, but he seems to be saying it all the time. But where he really became MVP in my heart was in the first episode when he unleashed a classic Hard Knocks tantrum in the receivers room. It's really what makes the show the show. At this point, it seems like all these guys are pretty much playing the cameras. And you know what? It's fantastic. More of that. Anytime someone gets a chance to just let go and unleash, it just makes you feel all good inside. And it does make you wish you could really do that in your own world. And maybe you can, maybe you can't, but it's fun to live vicariously through these pro athletes playing an incredibly dangerous game. It's usually a blast, and while this season's over, you can catch up on all the past seasons on many places online. Check out Hard Knocks. And that's our show. Subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, where you can leave a comment and a rating. Catch all past episodes on the homepage at petezambito.com/Pete's Percussion Podcast, the episodes. Find the show also on SoundCloud, Stitcher, and wherever else you get your podcasts. If you're on Facebook, like the page Pete's Percussion Podcast. You can contact me there, on Instagram and Twitter, at Pete Zambito, or by email at petesperkpod@gmail.com, and I'll catch you next time. Until then.